I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Kevin Dutton was last on a couple of years ago for his fascinating book, Split Second Persuasion, and now he's got a new book, an equally fascinating, engaging, and provocative one, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. The word psychopath is often related to violent murderers or other predators of an evil, sinister kind. Dr. Dutton, a research psychologist, looks at psychopaths and their traits, how they function, how they're wired, how they react, and how they prey on others. What he's found out in the course of his research, interviewing, and observations is interesting. It turns out we can learn a lot from the psychopath, even how their traits can translate to success for us. I'll get Dr. Dutton to tell us about this book and more. Kevin Dutton is a research psychologist at the Kaleva Research Center for Evolution and Human Science, Magdalen College, University of Oxford. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine and the Society for the Scientific Study of Psychopathy. He regularly appears on Talk Sports, The Late Show, and this book is to be adapted into a television series. His website is at kevindutton.co.uk. He joins me from Toronto this day. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Kevin Dutton. Dr. Dutton, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
I'm not too bad, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. So, just for people that might not understand what the term psychopath is, I mean, I mentioned in the intro that it's been sort of, I guess, co-opted into to meaning something evil. But is there a scientific definition, say, of what a psychopath is?
You know, you're right, Joe. No sooner is the word psychopath out, my friend, than images of Clifford Olson and Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy come stalking across our minds. But actually, when psychologists like myself talk about psychopaths, we're actually referring to someone with a distinct subset of personality characteristics. Now, those personality characteristics include ruthlessness, fearlessness, focus, mental toughness, coolness under pressure, charm, charisma, and the trademark, perhaps, lack of conscience and empathy. Now, notice, Joe, that I haven't mentioned violence there, and I haven't mentioned intelligence either. Now, if we have those set of characteristics that I just outlined for you there, and we also happen to be violent, and we also happen to be stupid, then, to be perfectly honest, my friend, your prospects aren't exactly going to be that great. You're going to smack a bottle over someone's head in a bar or stab them in a fight, and you're going to wind up in prison pretty quickly. However, if you have that subset of characteristics I was just telling you about, and you are also not naturally violent, and you are intelligent, let's say you go to a good school, that you get a good education, then it's a different ball game altogether. Then you're more likely, as the famous Reuters headline once put it, to make a killing in the market rather than anything else. Now, the final thing is, if you happen to be a psychopath, intelligent, and violent, well, now that's a very interesting combination. Now, any number of exotic occupations might await you, anything from special forces operative to the head of a criminal syndicate.
And sociopath, is that the same thing?
Well, the terms are used interchangeably, Joe, in the media. I mean, technically speaking, there is a difference, really, between sociopath and psychopath. When we talk about a sociopath, we're really talking about, I guess, to put it kind of crudely, a psychopath light. We're talking about someone whose psychopathic behavior may be more down to societal, hence the word socio, societal reasons due to contextual events, rather than maybe having the raw, natural, genetic, hardwired talent to be a psychopath. So, to give you a kind of an example, let's say you've got a leader of an inner-city gang in a rough area of town. Chances are, the leader of that gang might be psychopathic. But the chances also are that maybe members of that gang, who aren't the leader, may be more sociopathic. They may be acting psychopathically within that context, but when they get home to mummy or daddy, they might behave in a completely different way.
Huh. And so the psychopath, I guess the one way of putting it is that they don't feel emotion but they know how to respond to other people's emotions. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's kind of that's kind of true. I think one of the differences that we can draw with psychopaths is when we talk about, you know, generally speaking, psychopaths don't have empathy, is the distinction between what we call cold empathy, which is to do with reasoning and rational thought, with gauging rather dispassionately what another person might be feeling, and with what we might call hot empathy, which is the feeling of feeling what another person is feeling, if you get me. So that's the kind of empathy that that sparks up our amygdala, our emotion center in the brain. Now, it's very true to say that psychopaths tend to fall down on the second kind of empathy, the hot empathy. But there is evidence to suggest that with regard to the first kind, the cold empathy, they might even be better than the rest of us at cognitively and dispassionately gauging the way other people react and respond. You know, one psychopath put it to me when I was interviewing them, you don't need to have color vision to know how a traffic light works. All you need to do is know which bits are lit up. And that's very much the way that psychopaths actually navigate their way through everyday life. They are emotionally colorblind.
Yeah.
But just because they can see in monochromatic hues, that doesn't mean to say that they're not very good at gauging emotion. In fact, you know, as I say, flying on just the one empathy engine as opposed to two can actually predispose them to be great manipulators and persuaders.
Now, in this book, do you look at the psychopath and what motivates them? Like, what is their goal, essentially? I mean, whether they're bad or whether they're good?
Yeah. Great question, Joe. You know what? There's two things, really, two kind of axes of personality, which just sums up what turns the psychopath on. One is power, and two is getting what they want, and getting what they want right now. So psychopaths are into, they're not interested in waiting for stuff. So if they go after a goal, they go right after it, and they get it no matter what, and, you know, irrespective of the consequences. Now, the first facet that I was telling you about, power, that's very interesting. I ran a survey back in 2011, last year, called the Great British Psychopath Survey, and the survey was unique in the sense that it attempted to assess the prevalence of psychopathic characteristics within an entire national workforce. Now, participants were directed onto my website, where they completed a specialized questionnaire devised to assess the psychopathic personality, and they were then given their score. But that's not all. They also entered their employment details. Now, what would turn out to be the UK's most psychopathic profession, I wondered.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the results, to be perfectly honest, Joe, were a real eye-opener. CEOs came out as number one. Also, I have to say, not too great for you guys. Media, radio, mm-hmm. TV came up pretty high. Lawyers, no surprise there. Surgeons came up pretty high. But also, perhaps a bit of a shocker to some of the listeners, clergy, church people, think about number seven or number eight, which, when you look back on it, perhaps isn't so much as a surprise, because any situation, any professional environment, Joe, where you've got an organizational hierarchy, a power structure, where there is the opportunity for control and manipulation, where you can perhaps play hard and fast with the rules a little bit, these are situations in which psychopaths can do rather well for themselves.
And I guess clergy, or even Buddhist monks and the sort, they do well in moments of tension, and I think that's something that the psychopath is good at, right?
Well, I don't know about clergy in general, but certainly Buddhist monks. There's a number of characteristics, actually, which I've been speaking to a number of my colleagues about this, especially Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. Now, when I've been talking to him about some of the work that he's been doing with expert Buddhist monk meditators, it's become apparent to me that certainly in the lab, when you test say, psychopaths and expert Buddhist monk meditators on various lab tasks, they do display a number of similarities. Now, this doesn't mean to say that they're using the same brain areas to solve problems, etc., etc., but their behavior is similar. For instance, I'll give you a few examples. I mean, both Buddhist monks and psychopaths show a similar behavioral profile on something called the ultimatum game. Now, I'll very briefly tell you what that is. Now, the ultimatum game is a paradigm that we use in neuroeconomics, and it works like this. Imagine I've got a sum of money. Imagine I've got $100, and I'm going to distribute that money between you and I, okay? Now, you have to basically accept the deal that I'm going to give you, okay? Now, if I decide to split that money 50-50, I get $50, you get $50, you're likely to accept that, so will most other people. Where people start to say no, where they start to refuse the deal, is if I decide to split it, say, 70-30, yeah. 70 to me, 30 to you. That 70-30 seems to be the watershed. That seems to be the cutoff when people start thinking, well, actually, you know, you can stick your money, okay? Now, here is where psychopaths and Buddhist monks behave differently to the general population. Psychopaths have been shown in the lab, actually, to make more money on tasks like that because they focus on the reward. They focus on what they can get. They focus on the 30. Irrespective of whether I'm keeping 70, if they can get 30, they'll go with it. They don't kind of see that unfairness. Now, Buddhist monks also, expert Buddhist monk meditators, I should add, also make more money than normal people on such a task. They are also more likely to keep the 30, but for a completely different reason. They're kind of, we think, just maybe happier that you're getting the 70, and they'll keep the 30. But what seems to be the kind of common denominator between the two is that the emotion areas of the brains of the Buddhist monk meditators and the psychopaths seem to be toned down to such an extent that they don't feel the heat of that unfair deal. And there's a number of similarities I could go on, but we'll leave it there, I think, probably for the sake of the listeners. There are a number of similarities between Buddhists and psychopaths that are beginning to raise my eyebrows anyway.
Yeah. And did you find out what scares a psychopath?
Well, psychopaths really don't feel fear, actually, Joe. The amygdala, that part of the brain I was telling you about, which controls emotion, the emotional control tower located right in the middle of the brain in psychopaths, it tends to be underwired compared to the rest of us. So that kind of explains really why psychopaths in general can remain very cool under pressure when the rest of us might be scared stiff. So really trying to scare a psychopath, you're going to have your work cut out there.
Yeah, and in terms of, you mentioned the wiring in the brain, and this goes into brain development. Is this something that we're born with, or is this something that one develops over time?
It's very interesting that, Joe. I think when we talk about what causes psychopathy, whether it's kind of genetic or whether it's not genetic, I think we need to bring in a new emerging subdiscipline from the field of genetics called epigenetics. Now, epigenetics really looks at the way the environment switches on various genes that we might have innately. Now, and the analogy I always use, because it is a tricky kind of issue, the analogy I always use to make this a bit simpler, is to imagine that our genes, our genetic code, as it were, is like the text in a book. Okay, now let's say that book is lying atop of a library shelf. Now, if nobody opens that book, no one reads it, that information, that text, is not going to become live. That information is not going to have any impact on the world. However, if somebody comes and opens that book and starts reading it, then that information, that text, will have an impact on the world. So, as I say, for the text, read our genes, our genetic code, and for someone picking up and reading it, read environmental triggers. Now, let's come back to psychopathy. There is evidence, and not surprisingly, that there is a genetic component to psychopathy. Estimates vary around about 50%. But there is also evidence to suggest that that kind of genetic predisposition can be switched on by violent, abusive, or traumatic childhoods. So it's a little bit of both, my friend. It's not a cop-out, but that's where we are at the moment with that.
Now, in the course of writing this book, you obviously talked to a number of psychopaths. How did you find them? Was that through the survey, or in terms of speaking to them, did they, or do they, self-recognize? Like, are they proud, or how do they feel about being a psychopath?
Well, the one thing that most people kind of find when they research psychopaths and they meet them and interview them is that psychopaths really don't really think that they've got too much of a problem. I hate to be unfair on the guys, but if a psychopath starts, telling you, I've got a problem and I'm really sorry about my behavior and the problems I've caused other people and I need to do something about it, yeah, I think the warning bells as a clinician or as a parole officer really need to start ringing, because psychopaths are very good at telling you what they want to hear, what you want to hear. They're very good at manipulating you into thinking that they want to get better. So that's the first thing, Joe. The second thing is, when I meet psychopaths, of the clinical variety, and to a certain extent of the non-clinical variety, there's two kinds of types, really. What you find is that there is a kind of a very magnetic, charismatic, positive aura about them. And there's a reason for that, because they don't have any breaks on their personality. Psychopaths are brilliant at first impressions, Joe. So when you meet one, like you or I or the rest of the listeners, for example, whenever we go through lives, and we have an opportunity of doing something novel or new or slightly risky, our default tends to be to come up with reasons why we might not want to do that. It might be dangerous, or we might be frightened of various outcomes. We fear rejection. We fear failure. We have all of these kinds of hang-ups. Whereas a psychopath doesn't suffer from that kind of thing. They don't suffer from anxiety. They don't suffer from depression. So the very first thing that you kind of experience when you're around a psychopath is an aura of positivity and an aura of energy.
In terms of psychopathy and its depiction, say, in fiction, television, and the sort, I understand that you did a panel with Michael C. Hall, the guy who plays Dexter. Is that correct?
I did, yeah. We did that last week in New York. Actually, it was great fun. Actually, it was a sellout gig, and we talked about psychopaths in film and literature, and in particular Dexter, and how Michael gets into the role of playing him, and whether it has any spillover into his own life, after he comes off set.
Yeah, and so what have you found out in terms of its prevalence in popular culture? Does that, say, influence, it's a chicken and egg thing, which came first, the depictions in fiction, or the fact that we're living in, say, a less caring of a society?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. I think, my friend, that our fascination with psychopaths should be distinguished from our fascination with serial killers. Or more specifically, I should say, I think our preoccupation with both shares the same underlying mechanism but has different origins. Let's start with psychopaths. Whenever I ask someone, if I could turn you into a psychopath for half an hour with total impunity, what would you do? Most people come up with either a raft of vengeful actions against people who've done them wrong down the years, or alternatively, they take the opportunity to declare their undying affection for the unrequited love of their life, something along those lines. Now, the key phrase in what I just said is "with total impunity." Now, as soon as that 30 minutes is up, everything returns to normal as if nothing has happened. No regrets, no embarrassment, nothing. Now, that, of course, is the primary difference between psychopaths and the rest of us. Psychopaths simply don't give a damn about what their fellow citizens think of them. Now, therein, I think, lies the allure of the psychopath to most of us, Joe. I think in a world where our behavior is under closer and closer supervision, in the UK, I don't know what the situation is in Canada, in the UK there's roughly one closed-circuit TV camera for around every 20 people, I think it is now. What are we up to on Facebook now? Almost a billion users.
Right.
I think we long more than ever to be free from the shackles of societal restraint, though we know deep down that we probably wouldn't be able to handle the fallout if we were. But the psychopath can. And I think in that sense, we envy them their existential freedom, their fertile libertine imagination. But on that theme, Joe, I think that the serial killer fires our imagination in a different way. I think imagination at its root is practical. It evolved as a tool to help us examine the likely outcomes of possible courses of action, a way of literally looking at the potential risks and rewards of various things coming up before we choose the best path. So I think our ability to imagine terrible things prepares us to meet real dangers in the future or persuade us to walk in a different direction. Now, having said that, I think the one big fear that separates us humans from the animals, the rest of the animal kingdom, is death. Long before it happens, we know that we're going to die, and we know that there's not much we can do about that. And I think that this intense, uniquely human fear has a direct bearing on our enduring fascination with the serial killer. To me, to my mind, the serial killer represents the most implacable embodiment of death itself. It's the grim reaper, the intellect without heart. It doesn't respond to pleas of mercy. It has its own agenda. It's remorseless, the ultimate serial predator, the unrivaled monster in the closet that we've been preoccupied with since the days of our earliest childhood. And I think the basis of our fascination with the serial killer in film and literature is actually derived from quite a simple observation. Good always wins out in the end. In the world of fiction, the serial killer is defeated. The monster is caged and put back in its box. And we all breathe that collective sigh of relief. Our worst fears are laid to rest. So I think, ironically, the horror genre, the serial killer genre in both film and literature, has the kind of best of both worlds, in a sense. It has the ability to play on our greatest fears, but on the other hand, also the capacity to offer us the greatest relief.
Now, you begin the book by talking about your father. Your dad,
sure.
He looked like Dale Boy from Only Fools and Horses, and
yeah.
He sort of acted like him, right?
He did. Yeah. I think... Yeah, I mean, one of the personal reasons why I wrote the book, Joe, was actually, you know, it sounds crazy in hindsight, but to figure out my old man.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back on it, my dad was a nailed-down psychopath. He wasn't violent, but then again, one of the central messages in the book is to debunk the myth that you need to be violent to be a psychopath. He was a market trader. Not the stock market. He sold, little bits of this and that to people on the street. But he was, no doubt. He was ruthless, he was fearless, he was pretty shameless. I never, ever once saw my dad embarrassed in his entire life. And some of the stunts he used to get up to were extraordinary. I'll give you a quick example. I remember one time I was about 9 or 10. Couldn't have been any older than that. And we'd just had dinner in an Indian restaurant in London. And just as he was about to pay the bill, my dad suddenly gets to his feet, tinkles his glass against the spoon, and of course the entire restaurant goes quiet. And he then makes an impromptu speech, and he says, I'd just like to thank everyone for coming. I know that some of you have come from just round the corner and some of you have come from a little bit further afield, but I just want you to know that you're all equally welcome. Oh, and by the way, there's a drinks reception across the road in the King's Arms pub, and it would be lovely to see you there. And at this point, he starts to clap. At which point, so does the entire restaurant. So all of a sudden, we've got an entire restaurant of strangers who've never seen us before, who've never seen each other before, all applauding wildly because they don't want to be seen, of course, as the gate crashes to the party. Now, as we're going out the door, I remember saying to my dad, "Dad," I said, we're not, only about 9 or 10. I said, "We're not really going to the pub, are we?" And he says, "No, of course we're not, son." He says, "But that lot are. And my mate Malcolm has just taken over as landlord. He'll make a bit of money tonight."
Huh.
And that's the kind of thing he could do. I mean, can you imagine? I couldn't pay you $1,000 to do that, could I, Joe?
No.
But that was the kind of thing that my dad would do without batting an eye. That is that kind of shameless, fearless... I think the technical term that you need to do that is balls. Now, that's the kind of behavior that he was capable of without a moment's thought.
Now, the last time we talked a couple of years ago, you were at Cambridge. You've since moved on to Oxford. I read somewhere that you've moved into the offices that once belonged to C.S. Lewis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, yeah. C.S. Lewis's old office in the new buildings in Magdalen College. It overlooks the Deer Park, actually.
Yeah, what's that been like?
Oh, it's wonderful. I was terrified to open the wardrobe for a couple of weeks. I didn't know what I was going to find in there. but it's absolutely wonderful. I often wonder what C.S. Lewis would think of a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Lessons in Life from Saints, Spies and Serial Killers. We'll never know, but I like to think he might have had an open mind.
Yeah. What's next for you, Kevin?
Well, I think I'm going to spend a bit of time writing up a few papers which are outstanding, Joe. My missus, my other half, has insisted that I can't really write too much more on psychopaths, at least for the immediate future. She's had 2 years of living with this kind of writing and research, and it's taken me to some pretty interesting but dark places. And she's convinced I've scuttled a little bit further along the psychopathic spectrum myself than I was right at the beginning of the book. So I'm thinking maybe, Joe, in deference to my long-suffering other half, my immeasurably superior other half, to perhaps write a book on love. But I can't go into too much detail, of course. But I think we'll go the other end of the spectrum. We'll look at love.
Exactly. It's been delightful talking again. This is a great book. Best of luck with it.
Joe, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, as it was last time, my friend. And if ever you're in Oxford and you're a C.S. Lewis fan, give me a call and I'll be happy to show you around.
And the same if you're ever in Vancouver.
Okay, my friend. Good talking to you.
The website for more is at kevindutton.co.uk. The book is called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Dr. Kevin Dutton, on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.